this hike is that I wanted people to know better this disease that is so little known. So I did something that I think was important and that maybe people will relate to. The fact that I did this hike, some people understood it more than I hoped. It went beyond our hopes.
The 52-year-old hiker, previously a professional golfer, is now planning for a new challenge that includes a bike and a tricycle. But he believes that if he could encourage other patients to do sports, he will definitely win his challenge. Burpees are one of the gym exercises that many consider it either a funny workout or simply avoid to do. But that's not the case with a Brazilian man who set a new Guinness World Record with 951 burpees in just 1 hour. Cassiano Rodriguez Luriano, a professional mixed martial arts fighter, completed this feat nearly a month ago that was later verified by Guinness record adjudicators. Luriano says he was driven by a promise made to his niece, Rebecca, who was born with a severe heart disease, and the gym set up a fundraising effort for her. Luriano had originally aimed for 1,000 burpees, but fallen short of that mark due to a leg injury he sustained 2 days before the feat.
I'm tired. It didn't go as smoothly as I thought it would go. I'm in so much pain now on my leg because I got hurt. But I'm very, very happy with the accomplishment and in being able to help my niece. So that's the most important thing.
Luriano has not met his family since moving to Singapore in May 2019. He says the only way he could help them is using his athleticism. The previous world record was held by a Canadian who performed 879 chest-to-ground burpees within the same time limit in March this year.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight. An analysis draws upon several public health studies concludes that for every 4,434 metric tons of carbon dioxide pumped into the atmosphere beyond the 2020 rate of emissions, one person globally will die prematurely from the increased temperature. This additional carbon dioxide is equivalent to the current lifetime emissions of 3.5 Americans. We now present you an article authored by Oliver Millman, The piece is titled Study Finds Three Americans Create Enough Carbon Emissions to Kill One Person. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. According to the first analysis to calculate the mortal cost of carbon emissions, the lifestyles of around three average Americans will create enough planet-heating emissions to kill one person. And the emissions from a single coal-fired power plant are likely to result in more than 900 deaths. The new research builds upon what is known as the social cost of carbon, a monetary figure placed upon the damage caused by each ton of carbon dioxide emissions by assigning an expected death toll from the emissions that caused the climate crisis. The analysis draws upon several public health studies to conclude that for every 4,434 metric tons of carbon dioxide pumped into the atmosphere beyond the 2020 rate of emissions, one person globally will die prematurely from the increased temperature. This additional carbon dioxide is equivalent to the current lifetime emissions of 3.5 Americans. The research found adding a further 4 million metric tons above last year's level produced by the average U.S. coal plant will cost 904 lives worldwide by the end of the century. On a grander scale, eliminating planet-heating emissions by 2050 would save an expected 74 million lives around the world this century. According to Daniel Bresler of Columbia University's Earth Institute, who wrote the paper, the figures for expected deaths from the release of emissions aren't definitive and may well be a vast underestimate, as they only account for heat-related mortality rather than deaths from flooding, storms, crop failures, and other impacts that flow from the climate crisis. Pollution caused by the burning of fossil fuels is also directly killing people, with a landmark Harvard University study published in February of this year finding that more than 8 million globally are dying each year from the health effects of toxic air. Daniel Bresler of Columbia University's Earth Institute said, "There are a significant number of lives that can be saved if you pursue climate policies that are more aggressive than the business-as-usual scenario." He added, "I was surprised at how large the number of deaths are. There is some uncertainty over this. The number could be lower, but it could also be a lot higher." The research published in Nature Communications illustrates the vast disparities in the emissions generated by people's consumption in different countries around the world. The paper found, while it takes just 3.5 Americans to create enough emissions in a lifetime to kill one person, it would take 25 Brazilians or 146 Nigerians to do the same. The social or financial cost of carbon has become a widely used metric after its creation by economist William Nordhaus, who subsequently won a Nobel Prize in the 1990s. The measurement calculates the damage caused by a ton of carbon dioxide emissions, factored with the ability to adapt to the changing climate. Under Nordhaus's DICE model, the 2020 social cost of carbon is $37 a metric ton, but Daniel Bresler's addition of the mortality cost brings this figure up to $258 a ton. This change to the model would imply that an economically optimal policy would be to radically reduce carbon dioxide emissions to reach full decarbonization by 2050, a scenario that has also been backed by climate scientists as one that would avoid the worst ravages of global warming. Daniel Bresler of Columbia University's Earth Institute said, Nordhaus came up with a fantastic model, but he didn't take in the latest literature on climate change's damage upon mortality. There's been an explosion of research on that topic in recent years. Colonel Wagner, a climate economist at New York University who was not involved in the research, said that the social cost of carbon is a crucial policy tool, but is also very abstract. He said, that makes attempts to translate our climate impact into more relatable terms so important. He added, the new research on the mortality cost shows the results are certainly dramatic. A series of heat waves have swept the globe over the past month, including the dramatic heat and wildfires in the U.S. Pacific Northwest, where temperature records in Seattle, Washington, and Portland, Oregon were shattered and caused hundreds of people to die from heat stroke and other related conditions. Scientists say the climate crisis, driven by carbon dioxide emissions, is making heat waves far more frequent and severe. Daniel Bresler of Columbia University's Earth Institute said that while this paper looked at the emissions caused by individual activity, the focus should instead be on policies that impact businesses and governments that influence carbon pollution on a societal scale. He said, my view is that people shouldn't take their per-person mortality emissions too personally. Our emissions are very much a function of the technology and culture of the place that we live in.
The subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address the ongoing issues across the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. As usual, we will try to explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard with extra help from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about revelations about the Indian government using Israeli military-grade spyware to hack into phones and other digital devices of dozens of citizens and high-ranking officials. And we shall take a look at the repercussions of the Pegasus scandal for Modi's administration following allegations of treason and compromising national security.
Of media agencies has recently revealed a long list of journalists, activists, politicians, and a lot of other public figures that were targeted by their governments using high-tech Israeli spyware. The government of Narendra Modi is one of them. The allegations that these governments were paying hefty sums of money for annual subscriptions and extra fees to an Israeli company for illegal surveillance of citizens have started protests in many countries. But the Pegasus scandal may have grave consequences for the Indian government, something as big as the Watergate for the United States.
The Pegasus Project is the umbrella name of a global consortium of media groups that was formed to probe if governments used the Israeli malware Pegasus for espionage on journalists, politicians, activists, business people, and many other public figures. Over 80 journalists from 17 media organizations spent several months analyzing and investigating the alleged spying abuses.
investigative journalist, that's the only interesting thing that I do. I think those who surveilled me and my colleague Andras, they were after my sources. They wanted to access the drafts, the stories that we were preparing, so that we don't break any news that they are not aware of. I think they also tried to find out if they can find anything that could be used as a compromise on us, but obviously there was nothing.
Pegasus was never a secret. It was ostensibly marketed for surveillance of serious crimes and terrorism. But in 2020, it became a scandal. A list of 50,000 phone numbers of potential targets of the spyware was leaked to the journalism NGO Forbidden Stories.
The question that really arises is who is doing it. Now, if you look at the various points, which is journalists getting tapped, opposition leaders getting tapped, even government ministers are getting tapped. So who could be gaining out of it? One obvious answer is the government itself will be gaining out of it, right? And therefore, the government is a potential suspect in terms of running this. One school of thought is that, well, the government does have the right to surveil, because that's part of the job of the government, to make sure that you surveil those who are against the interests of the country and make sure that the country stays safe.
The analysis revealed that the list contained the numbers of leading opposition politicians, human rights activists, lawyers, and other political dissidents. The International Investigative Journalism Initiative says India is among the 45 countries using the malware developed by the cyber arms group NSO, which is an Israeli company previously owned by American private equity firm Francisco Partners and is overseen by the Israeli Ministry of Military Affairs.
If the reports are true, it means New Delhi is running a mass surveillance program to keep tabs on its opposition journalists, activists, and leaders, along with its own ministers and key officials. The implications of these revelations can be huge for Indians. It may change India's domestic political environment, which in turn can have drastic effects on the country's foreign politics. It can also influence citizens' view and trust on their relationships with governmental institutions.
Pegasus can be covertly installed on mobile phones and other digital devices to take over its operations and track every element. The malware is a Trojan horse named after the mythical winged horse Pegasus, flying through the air, infecting phones. Since its 2016 version, Pegasus was capable of offline conversations, reading text messages, gathering data from call logs, location tracking, collecting passwords and browsing history, harvesting information from apps, including but not limited to communications apps iMessage, Gmail, Viber, Facebook, WhatsApp, Telegram, and Skype. The 2021 Pegasus revelations suggest that the current Pegasus software can exploit all devices running almost all versions of iOS and Android.
I think the question would probably start from the past of our privacy. I think by the time it was 2005, 2006, we had smartphones all over the place. We had deep penetration of digital and access to digital. We had already lost privacy. All that Pegasus is doing is showing the mirror to us. We have completely and fundamentally lost our privacy. There was a statement, in fact, from Larry Ellison, the CEO of Oracle, saying that privacy is a figment of imagination. It does not exist anymore. And with Pegasus, it's saying is what has already happened in the last decade or so, if not more. And you know, as I wrote in one of the newspapers or magazines, that Pegasus can see exactly what you're seeing, can hear exactly what you're hearing, can read all the messages that you have, and therefore you fundamentally are not left with any privacy on the digital platform.
Rather than using a specific way of attack, Pegasus is a suite of exploits that uses many vulnerabilities in the system. Its infection vector includes clicking links, the Photos app, the Music app, and iMessage. But Pegasus also uses zero-click attacks, which means it can infect and run phones without any interaction from the victim. It gets installed by a missed call or a message, and the individual is not even required to open a link.
According to media reports, the prices to use the spyware are extremely high. Governments must pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in annual fees, plus some extra charges, to the Israeli cyber intelligence firm for surveillance over a number of phones. So what justifies paying such high amounts to hack phones of a few people related to politically sensitive issues? And what kind of intelligence do the governments hope to get?
Documents submitted before a U.S. court indicate that an amount of $8 million was the initial agreed amount only to set up a Pegasus system in Ghana to spy on 25 phone numbers during 2015-16. The end user was supposed to pay the NSO group an annual support fee of 22% of the system consideration costs, which means $176,000 annually. According to reports, Mexico's contract was $32 million for monitoring 500 users, whereas Panama had reportedly signed to pay $13.4 million to spy on 150 devices.
I don't think it's any political threat in that sense, frankly. If I look at today's newspaper, which is a couple of days after the first news of Pegasus broke out, I don't see much of a impact coming out. There were a few days of ruckus happening in the parliament, and like in any other cases, the public has very short memory. So I don't think it's a question of survival at all. I don't even think it's a scratch on the government's position right now. I think much more will have to happen before an issue of cyber or an issue of surveillance becomes an equivalent of the Watergate or any of the gate kind of situation. So I don't think we have reached there as of now. I don't think it has any impact on the survival of the government, and that's a far-fetched question in that sense at this stage.
According to a New York Times report, NSO Group charged $650,000 plus 17% of the total amount as an annual service fee to spy on 10 iPhone users in 2016. Emails leaked by WikiLeaks showed that the NSO Group had competitors who offered similar capabilities with lower prices to win government contracts.
The NSO Group often assigned nicknames to its operating customers. In a 2018 report by Canada-based research organization Citizen Lab, it was revealed that NSO operators associated with the Indian subcontinent were codenamed Ganges. Similarly, operators linked to activities in the Middle Eastern countries like Qatar, Oman, and the UAE were just named Middle. The Ganges project included opposition leaders, union ministers, administrators such as election commissioner and heads of the Central Bureau of Investigation, or the CBI, and also minority leaders.
Under the Indian law, the government is only allowed to intercept calls in certain situations, such as the interests of the sovereignty and integrity of India or the security of the state and its friendly relations with foreign states or public order. These are the same restrictions imposed on free speech under the Constitution.
It's a job of the government to do surveillance on a set of people who are supposed to be perceived as inimical to the interests of the country. And therefore, a few hundred thousand dollars is really not that much of a cost compared to, let's say, the cost of a missile, cost of a warplane, and so on and so forth. So if you can avoid a war through surveillance or avoid a terrorist attack through surveillance, I'm sure the taxpayers' money are getting well used. The challenge comes in when the same technology is being used for surveilling people who are not really inimical to the interests of the country, but are inimical to civilian issues, between perhaps political parties or business entities and so on and so forth. which then does not let us have our way of life, right? And therefore, the question will come up if, you know, why is the government using taxpayer money for such surveillance? But then we don't even know whether the government is actually using taxpayers' money and is actually doing the surveillance. That's in the realm of speculation. But if this government or any government is doing so, then that's certainly not acceptable.
However, the exhaustive list leaves no sphere of India's socio-political landscape free of the Pegasus hacking. Now, India's main opposition Congress party accuses Prime Minister Modi of treason and demands an investigation into the role of Modi and his closest aide, Home Minister Amit Shah, in the scandal. The cell phones of India's top opposition leader, Rahul Gandhi, his two close aides, and five non-political friends were also compromised by Pegasus in the run-up to the 2019 national elections, which Modi won. During that election campaign, one of the election commissioners objected to Modi's polarizing speeches. His phone, as well as that of a journalist reporting his official stance, was also hacked by Pegasus.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Paranjoy Guha Thakorta. He is an Indian journalist, writer, and a documentary maker. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Thakorta. As we mentioned earlier in the program, the Pegasus Project, the global consortium of media organizations that investigates the Israeli spyware, says India is amongst the 45 countries using the malware developed by the Israeli group NSO. Now, do you think New Delhi is really running a mass surveillance program to keep tabs on its journalists, activists, and opposition leaders, along with its own ministers and key officials?
Well, honestly, I don't know who I should believe or who I should not believe. Because the Israeli group NSO claims that its software is only sold to vetted governments, and that too after the permission of the government of Israel in Tel Aviv. And they also claim that this is only meant for law enforcing agencies so that they can pick out heinous crimes like pedophilia, like drug trafficking, like anti-terrorist activities, if some people are kidnapped, if some human beings are under the rubble of a collapsed building to detect them. So they say this is all used for such purposes. But what do you do once the software is in the hands of another government or another agency? Does the NSO have any means of checking the misuse or the abuse of that software? So if there are rogue elements in another country who has got access to this software, who's using the software to spy on citizens, including the political opponents of the ruling regime in that country, and maybe judges and journalists and bureaucrats and law enforcing agencies and human rights activists and anybody. So that is a big question mark and a problematic area. Now, in 2019, when it was found that NSO software was being misused through WhatsApp and through a link sent by WhatsApp, WhatsApp is currently pursuing a legal case against NSO in a court in the United States of America in the West Coast in San Francisco. That case is currently on.
So what are the possible implications of these revelations on India's domestic and foreign politics, and also the citizens' view about the government's institutional relationships?
There are two sets of implications, one within India and one outside India. Because this does not concern India alone. There are allegedly 50,000 phone numbers in this list that has been given to Forbidden Stories, which is a Paris-based not-for-profit non-government organization. And they have collaborated with Amnesty International, and they have a digital lab where they've examined these, some of these phones, including mine, that were allegedly hacked. Now wait, there's more to it than meets the eye. These 50,000 phones which are on the list are in 45 countries. There are 17 media organizations in different parts of the world who have collaborated on this investigation, including not just Forbidden Stories and Amnesty International, but media organizations like the Washington Post, Le Monde of France, The Guardian of the UK, The Wire in India, among others. Now, when the Minister for Home Affairs in India, Mr. Amit Shah, he says that there is an international conspiracy. The international conspiracy is targeted at India. Yes, there are a large number of names that have been verified that have come from India. And it was time that it was released on Sunday night, and on Monday morning, the monsoon session of the Parliament of India was to begin. So the government has claimed this was targeted in India, it was a conspiracy against India. But the fact is, the phone numbers are there of people below in 45 countries, that there are 17 media organizations, so I'm not so sure whether there's an international conspiracy. But if you look at the international ramifications of it, India's Prime Minister, Mr. Narendra Modi, has had very close relations with the former head of government of the U.S. Of Israel, I beg your pardon, the former head of the government of the Israel, who is not there. I mean Mr. Bibi Netanyahu. Now the present government, that is Mr. Bennett, is now in charge. And so that's one part of the story. But we also see, we don't know, because NSO doesn't disclose the list of clients. We don't know who has purchased it. Because there is one view that among the people, or among the governments, or the law enforcing agencies, or the government agencies that has purchased it, are agencies in Saudi Arabia and also in the United Arab Emirates, who have, in the recent past, their relations with Tel Aviv has been a little less tense than in the past.
Thank you, Mr. Thakorta. Let's take a break and take a look at how the global media has covered the Indian side of this global scandal.
This is not the first time Pegasus has been linked to the targeting of journalists and human rights activists. In 2019, there was outrage in India and other countries after WhatsApp confirmed that some of its users were targeted with spyware. A total of 121 users from India, including activists, scholars, and journalists, were affected by the breach. This, experts said, suggested the involvement of state agencies in India. WhatsApp sued NSO, alleging the company was behind cyber attacks on 1,400 mobile phones involving Pegasus. Reactions from the Modi government to the revelations have been predictably hostile. Instead of receiving this information and promising, even if skeptically, a full investigation, Home Minister Amit Shah has turned to one of his favorite retorts as an explanation, that the project is an international conspiracy to derail India's development trajectory. Many of his party colleagues have also been spouting the same line, saying that the investigation has been timed to coincide with the parliament restarting again.
Welcome back, Mr. Thakorta. India's main opposition Congress Party has accused Prime Minister Modi of treason and demanded an investigation into the roles of Modi and his closest aide, Home Minister Amit Shah, in the scandal. How do you think Modi will try to handle or survive this?
Only time can answer that question. So far, Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Home Minister Amit Shah have denied that they've done anything illegal. Yes, the India's biggest opposition party, its leader Rahul Gandhi, has accused the Prime Minister and the Home Minister of treason because they're saying you are using defense-grade spyware to spy on your own citizens, and you are and you're not saying who bought the software, whether you bought it or not bought it, and this is akin to treason. It's akin to compromising the interests of the country. We'll have to wait and watch what happens. But so far, the government of India in New Delhi seems to be in a complete state of denial. Whether it'll continue, it has refused to accede to opposition demand for a joint parliamentary committee, or we'll have to wait and watch. There have been petitions in the Supreme Court about whether there should be a Supreme Court monitored independent investigation. It's early days as to see what would be the political fallout of this episode.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Fakorta for being on the program. Now, let's see how people on social media have reacted to the Indian government's large-scale surveillance scheme.
Former Indian minister and member of ruling party Subramanian Swamy says, "The government of India owes explanation to people as to who paid the Israeli firm for the Indian operation." Revant Reddy, an Indian parliamentarian and member of the main opposition party, accuses the Modi government of U-turn, saying it must be transparent on the Pegasus Snoopgate. Senior Indian journalist Sushant Singh, whose number also figures on the list, says Pegasus is a cyber weapon and a controlled defense export from Israel that India used against its own citizens. Seema Sirohi, a senior Indian journalist, says when India appears alongside countries like Saudi Arabia for using government might for the wrong reasons, something is terribly wrong.
And that was our episode on the Pegasus scandal, or revelations about the Indian government's costly collaboration with an Israeli cyber company to spy on a number of opposition public figures and politicians, as well as its influence on the future of Modi's government. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Okay, this is a special program. We interrupt our regular coverage to bring you coverage of the endorsement ceremony for the president-elect, new Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi. This is a live coverage of the endorsement ceremony for President-elect Ebrahim Raisi. We just have the Interior Minister, Abdulrazak Rahmani Fazli, making a speech. Okay, let's go and listen in.
Greetings and pay respect to the leader of the Islamic Revolution and the participants. I thank God for providing me with the opportunity to present a report about the 13th presidential elections, to present this report to the leader, the audience, and also the nation of Iran. Undoubtedly, the religious popular rule is one of the criterion of the Islamic establishment, and in this way all those holding positions are directly or indirectly selected by people's votes. On this basis, the Islamic Republic of Iran, since its formation, has managed to hold 40 nationwide elections and 11 nationwide elections are related to midterm elections in the past 8 years, and these elections have been held in a secure and sound manner with great deal of precision. Now, speaking of the 13th presidential election, what draws a distinction between the 13th presidential election with the others is the imposition of the toughest tyrannical and illegal sanctions and the creation of problems and economic constraints for the people, continued coronavirus pandemic and its consequences, and also an unprecedented onslaught by the media, foreign media outlets, and the holding of the 6th rural and urban council elections, and also the midterm parliamentary elections. In order to hold glorious presidential elections, various activities were predicted and were executed that I'm going to refer to these activities. The Interior Ministry, as a ministry in charge of holding the elections, set up the election headquarters and made the necessary arrangements and took into consideration the leaders' guidelines, and also received support by the president and made the coordination with the guardian, with the Constitutional Council, and maintained impartiality and maintained security in order to create an atmosphere for sound competitions, and made efforts in order to contribute to the holding of glorious elections with a massive participation by the people. And following these efforts by my colleagues and also at the Interior Ministry and colleagues at the governor offices, and close cooperation by the Constitutional Council and the law enforcement and intelligence organs, and cooperation by IRIB and political parties and factions, and unity amongst all ethnicities. The coronavirus pandemic led to new arrangements, and this was a new experience by reviewing experiences by other countries, and based on the existing legislative regulations, various activities were carried out in order to observe the health protocols, and activities were carried out for increasing the number of polling stations, and there was no need for fingerprinting in the course of these elections. Those in charge of executing the elections underwent training courses. There were 12 briefing sessions in provinces, in-person and online sessions, and that included 1,150,000 individuals, including governors, political deputies, the governors and district governors, And also that included members of polling stations. For this round of elections, while considering the ballot papers, these ballot papers were printed in order to protect people's votes. More than 10 safety indices were considered. And based on the arrangements made, there was no shortage of ballot papers. In order to implement Article 31 of the electoral law, the Central Commission at the Interior Ministry, attended by the Intelligence Minister and the Attorney General, there were 5 sessions held. Appropriate decisions were made in order to facilitate the holding of the elections. Moreover, 1,129 executive committees were set up in provinces, and it was eventually confirmed by the Central Committee in order to facilitate the casting of votes. There were polling stations across the country. Compared to the previous round, there has been a considerable growth in the number of these polling stations, and in cooperation with the Foreign Ministry, necessary grounds were made for the participation of Iranian expats in such a way that elections were held in 101 countries, bearing in mind the coronavirus pandemic, that included 133 political missions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and that included 234 polling stations in collaboration with the Constitutional Council. 24 stages related to the holding of electronic elections that included detecting the identity. That has been done in a mechanized manner, and many cases of law violations were prevented. That included voting using forged ID cards or using IDs belonging to deceased persons. All these were prevented, and at the same time, the use of ballot papers were managed. And this was done in an online manner. The security headquarters was set up in order to maintain security. 307,000 members of the military intelligence and law enforcement organs were involved, and despite security threats and intelligence assessments, the elections were held in a secure manner. In order to guarantee sound elections, the 70,000 individuals were appointed as inspectors. This is in addition to the inspectors from the Constitutional Council. There was also a commission set up in order to make the arrangements for all the candidates to receive equal services, government services, and also attending IRIB programs. $59,310,307 persons were qualified and eligible to vote. There despite the problems faced, as mentioned in this report, there was 48.08% participation, and Dr. Sayed Ebrahim Raisi had 18 million, more than 18 million votes, and he was elected as the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The Constitutional Council confirmed the elections, and even a single vote was not rejected, and that indicates efforts made by those in charge of holding the elections and their sound performance in the course of in making inspections and observing the sound holding of elections. I wish to thank the leader and also the president and the members of the Constitutional Council and members of the Central Committee for the Central Headquarters for Elections, the country's election headquarters, and the polling stations across the country, and the staff of the Interior Ministry, governors, governor generals, the judiciary, the intelligence, security, law enforcement forces, the intelligence ministry, foreign ministry, and all the candidates and the supporters, the journalists, IRIB, and more importantly, the great Iranian nation, who through their participation in the elections contributed to the country's progress. I thank them all. I wish to once again congratulate Dr. Raisi as the 13th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and wish him and his government wish success for him and his government. And I also wish to thank Dr. Rouhani and his administration.
Okay, you've just listened to a live speech by Iran's Interior Minister, Abdulrazza Rahmani Fazli, who talked about the June 18th presidential elections in Iran. It was also the municipal and local elections. He said Ebrahim Raisi garnered 48.08% of the vote and was a convincing winner of this election. 27.9 million Iranians, eligible voters, took part in the election. Almost 28 million Iranians took part in the election. He said that because of the coronavirus pandemic and various other factors, the participation, the turnout was lower this time than compared to last time, but it was still a very respectable turnout. Almost 28 million Iranians turned out for the elections. And he also thanked all election officials and the Iranian people for making this a success. Okay, we're now about to listen to the second speaker in this endorsement ceremony for the president-elect, for Iran's new president, Ebrahim Raisi. The second speaker now is head of the leader's office, Gulpai Ghani. Let's listen in.
Things of God upon him and his progeny. I thank God Almighty due to His grace and made this country emerge victorious in the such a test that is the presidential elections, and in such a complicated and difficult situation, the people through their massive turnout in the elections put on display the role of people's votes in the administration of affairs in this country, and by selecting a scholarly person and a popular figure who is pious and has brilliant record of management, and in this way the nation put on display the firm resolve in order to tread the path of this revolution, which is the path of justice and dignity. This country today is in need of services and making a leap in progress, and is in need of a jihadi management and a courageous management in order to put on display the potentials of this nation, particularly the potentiality of the youths, and mobilize such capabilities, and in this way eliminate the impediments in the path of production and pursue the policy of strengthening the value of the country's national currency and empower the nation with respect to, in the face of economic hardships, and pave the way for the country to attain further progress. I wish to thank the people, and while respecting their choice, in this way, Dr. Raisi is endorsed as the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I pray to God to grant him success, and I wish to remind that people's votes and my endorsement will continue as long as the path of revolution is going to be pursued by him, and that will be true with the grace of God. Sayyid Ali Khamenei,
okay, you've just listened to the head of the leader's office, Golpay Ghani, making a speech on behalf of the leader. Ayatollah Golpay Ghani read out Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's official endorsement of President-elect Ebrahim Raisi, and this was the leader of the Islamic Revolution's official endorsement of President-elect Ebrahim Raisi. You just listened to that. We're now waiting for our next speaker, Mohammadi Golpay Ghani, the head of the leader's office, just completed his speech and read out the official endorsement of President-elect Ebrahim Raisi. Well, it now looks as if President-elect himself, Ebrahim Raisi, is about to make a speech. Let's listen.
Greetings to you all. In the name of God, the Merciful, the Compassionate, salutations to the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Salutations to Imam Reza, peace be upon him.
Sheikh شرط ادب و احترام در حکم تنفیذ از سوی رهبری معظم انقلاب این بود که من دست مبارک ایشون رو
speaking of the endorsement I had to kiss the hands of the leader for his endorsement of my presidential mandate, but due to the health protocols I did not have this chance. I thank God Almighty for his